of giving me one.
Which was all right, because we hadn't thought of it. We hoped Errol wouldn't stay for the summer. He was an ongoing irritation in our normally harmonious daily life. We were annoyed by his treatment of Anna and his general mockery of the hermitage routine, especially his flouting of the rule of silence during the day.
He has been sent to test us.
We get tested by people like him all the rest of the year.
Well, then he's just been sent to test me. And so far I'm failing the test. It's fascinating. I've been thinking a lot about living in such a rarefied, loving atmosphere all these years. And that if I was to live in the outside world, possibly I might be quite different. A cantankerous, difficult person.
Joe had always diminished his holy manhood to himself, as well as to others, but now he wondered if he'd underplayed it half enough. He decided to talk it over with Ho.
I think if I were not on this mountain, it might turn out that I was not a holy man after all.
Ho simply laughed and walked away. When the children saw the newly washed robes, they wanted one each, and they also wanted shaved heads. When it was Anna's turn to have her head shaved, she said she didn't want to.
Unfortunately, this became a bone of contention with the others. They felt she was setting herself apart from the rest of them, or they felt she was too attached to her prettiness, or worst-case scenario, she was not shaving her hair because Errol didn't want her to. There was a lot of lively discussion around this issue. Everyone voiced an opinion, and I listened to them all. Anna did not assume a defensive stance. She listened eagerly to all that was said, but still, she did not want to shave her head.
I said that I would hang on to my hair, unless Joe saw fit to hand down a decree against it. I didn't want to cause dissension. I didn't want to be different from the others, not at all. I was proud to be one of them. I looked into my heart to see if it was vanity at work, but I don't feel that it was. I'd never thought of myself as a beauty, quite the contrary. I'd been scrawny and homely as a child, and I kept that image of myself into adulthood. I'd never used makeup, and in my life as a mother and nurse, I'd always dressed in a practical, colourless fashion. It's true that I had gone through a brief passage of sowing wild oats, during which I'd been unduly attached to a pair of cowboy boots and a leather jacket with long fringes on the sleeves, but that wonderful period had been curtailed by pregnancy and marriage. I still got the cowboy boots. In fact, I actually wore them on my first pilgrimage to the Hermitage, and I brought them with me this time, too. They'd make me feel tall, and they put an extra spring in my step.
I'd like to say that my hair is nothing special except that it's red. It's neither short nor long, curly nor straight. I know that some women have a fetish about hair, but I don't. Nor is this a Samson issue. I don't feel I'll be deprived of my strength by shorn hair. It's just a part of me that I feel belongs. Oh, I'm surprised there is all this fuss about it.
I actually like having my hair off. It seems to make me lighter for my running, and feels a lot cooler too. But I can see it might be harder for a woman.
It's not harder. It's easier. Nothing to bother about. No combing or styling. Hair is a hassle.
I have to admit, I never liked my hair. I mean, I pretty much wear it this way all year round now, and of course, as a chef, there is nothing I hate more than hair getting in food.
Musicians are supposed to have long hair. I felt much more romantic and dashing, playing with my long hair all a quiver, an extension of the notes. And the dramatic forward flop of it as I made my bow was incredibly pleasing. But I gave it up for the good of the group.
Maybe also for the good of your cello playing. However, it is essential for poets to have long hair. Who ever heard of a bald-pated poet? If we're going to start patting ourselves on the back for shaving our heads, I am surely the noblest.
Lawyer's hair should be just so, but not just so shaved. Nevertheless, my friends, I bet you have noticed that, unlike losing a limb, it grows back.
You see, Anna, it grows back. You are making too much of a big deal out of it.
I think it is all of you who are making a big deal out of it, not me. I simply don't think it's important.
I agree. Shaving heads is not important. And not shaving heads is not important.
Joe, the children, and Anna were sitting on the ground on the edge of the slope, watching the sun go down, which they declared as good as television, the way the clouds changed color and shape. And the screen was endless.
Joe, today I was fighting with Melissa.
Yes, it was Mummy.
Mum, as usual, told me to be nice, but why? Sometimes I don't feel like being nice. Sometimes being nice is boring.
That's when you should just go off and be by yourself until you feel nice again. Not take it out on other people, especially someone smaller than you.
I just want a reason to be nice. Then when I feel mean, I can just think of a reason and stop.
Good idea. Anna, give Jimmy and Melissa a reason.
Being nice is good luck.
I like that. Why didn't I come up with that in all these years? You see, children, your mother is a truly wise woman.
But what is good luck?
Maybe it's getting presents.
I used to feel very lucky to get a present, until one time some years ago. It was when the Hermitage was just beginning to be discovered by people. I lived here with four monks, and we were very poor. It had been years since we'd bought any new clothes, and we'd become a very ragtag band of holy men. Then one day, a woman who'd enjoyed a fruitful visit with me said she wanted to give us some money. I accepted it with thanks, and bought some new robes for us all. Only a month went by, and she came back, wanting to know how I'd spent the money. The five of us stood in a line, displaying our beautiful robes, which were more of a reddish-brown colour back then. "I am pleased," she said. "I will go away satisfied that you are wearing my robes." "Well, not really your robes," I said, "for remember that someone had to grow the cotton. Another person picked it. Someone else spun the thread for someone to weave the cloth, which yet another person dyed. And then, after we bought the cloth, Jorge here cut the pattern and John sewed the cloth. So really, the robes are a gift from many hands." That's just nitpicking," she said. "Let me take a picture so I can show my friends that the holy man and his monks are wearing my robes." "Absolutely not," I said. "That is forbidden." She laughed and danced away and snapped the shot. By then we had turned away or thrown up our hands, but I suppose she had captured the robes. Maybe not, though. I've never heard of a stolen picture of any of us that has actually come out. Well, anyway, children, this woman became an incredible pest. She always wanted special treatment when she came, and she came often. Because we were wearing what she insisted on calling her robes, she felt she owned us. I have to confess to a nasty thrill the summer she came and found us in brand new costumes, the beautiful wheat-coloured robes that we wear to this day. Her face clenched in a terrible frown. "What happened to my robes?" she asked furiously. "Oh, well, they became wonderful cloths, which we use for dusting and scrubbing," I said, showing her the cut-out squares, which were thin and frayed, but still useful. "Well, you can have your old rags," she said. "Oh, thank you very much," I said. "At long last, your generous gift belongs to us."
"Joe,
Is it true that pictures of you and the monks don't come out?
Yes. Once, there was a young photographer down in the town who got the idea he would sell pictures of the holy man to people who were on their way up the mountain to get in the line. He felt sure that in no time he'd be a rich man. He'd heard that the holy man himself took turns coming down to the town to get supplies, so he thought he'd be able to take my picture furtively. But there was one problem. No one knew which of us was the holy man, since we all dressed the same way. Well, that isn't strictly true, because for all the years I've been here, I've always gone to the park to play with the children. And although different monks have come and gone over the years, there's only been one monk who has remained year in and year out to play with the children, many of whom are now grown-ups. So really, the whole town knows who I am at some level of their consciousness. Anyhow, this photographer sneaked around and took photographs of each one of us and figured afterwards he would find out which one was me, even if he had to climb the mountain himself to look at my face. But when he developed the photographs, they were out of focus or overexposed, underexposed, or the monk's face was turned away, or someone had got in front of him just before he shot the picture. He decided he should quit before the word got out that he was a terrible photographer. He'd gone from wanting to make a fortune to just not wanting to lose his business. But many of the townspeople, the grown-up children I had played with, when they learnt what he had tried to do, stopped coming to his shop. You see, the town is very proud of the fact that it has never tried to commercialize the presence of the holy man on its mountain. They are pleased with all the extra business the pilgrims bring, and are content with that. But I was curious, so I went to the young man's shop. Alim was his name. I told him I'd like to buy the pictures. I recognized him from years ago. He'd been a very nice little boy. I guess he recognized me too, because after I left, he hung up a big sign saying, "The Holy Man shops here." That man was incorrigible.
You know what, Joe? There should be a picture of you for when you die.
Do you think so? Well, then why don't you draw a picture of me?
Okay.
Me too. I want to draw one too.
The sun had set, and it was dark by now. So they went inside and established themselves at the long dining table with paper, pencils, and crayons. Joe sat still, posing for his picture. Jimmy got lost in an elaborate picture of dinosaurs. Melissa, however, stuck to her guns and soon presented Joe with a picture of himself. His head was oddly shaped, with extra-large ears, different-sized eyes, a potato nose, and open mouth slightly smiling. His arms grew out of his head, and his legs came out of his chin, with spidery hands and feet. He appeared to be flying.
Huh. I am so happy. You know, this will be my official portrait for when I die.
After the children had been put to bed, Anna found Joe in the common room, talking with the others.
What happened to the photographer, Alim, when he put the sign in the window saying the holy man shops here?
Well, a week or so went by. And then he arrived on my doorstep, huffing and puffing, very red in the face. In those days, the line was short and spent itself each day, so unless I was busy around the hermitage, a visitor got an audience fairly soon. I remember I was busy whittling some chopsticks and amusing myself by carving little animals at the top of them. Whatever became of all those chopsticks I used to whittle?
I think every monk who spent time here with you has a pair of those chopsticks in his home. I know I do.
Oh, Well, then I'd better make some for Anna. Anyhow, back to Alim. We sat outside in the boulder garden, or rather, I sat and he stood. The birds were busy feeding their chicks, and I remember also that there was a single predatory bird circling above, endlessly patient, waiting for its moment to swoop down for one of the babies, periodically casting its sky-crossing shadow on the nests. One of us always tried to be in the nesting area during that vulnerable time, but still, nestlings were lost, and drops of blood scarred the rocks. Oh. Anyway, Alim began talking at once, and never drew breath. He must have been breathing through his ears. He said, "Just because I have been imaginative enough to put that sign in my window, they want to run me out of town. The holy man's shop's everywhere, they say, and the rest of us do not have signs." So? Is it my fault that they've never thought of it? Is it my fault that in this town no businessman has had an original thought for 1,000 years? I mean, correction, 15 years, the years that you've been here and dampened the town's ardour for progress. I want to get ahead, to make a fortune, to make a name for myself. But they just care about making enough to eat and drink and having time to watch the game of the dappled ponies. Aha, I thought. My wild young Alim has been to war. Alim has drawn blood, like our sky-circling bird is trying to do. You see, Anna, as Ho can tell you, or Jacob, only men who have been in combat are able to see the game that is played from the backs of the stumpy-legged ponies.
Or so the old warriors say.
Alim, who had run up the mountain in the heat of his wrath and his sense of being terribly wronged, went on to say, "It's probably because you played with us as children that we all wanted to grow up and be like you. Remember, Alim, how we used to all sit together and breathe," I said. "I think you've forgotten how to breathe. You might take a moment now to inhale and exhale, to relax. Please, Alim, won't you sit down?" No, I can't stay," he said, waving his arms as if my inhales and exhales were swarming around his head. I just thought you should know that you are wrecking my career."
"No.
I think it's fine you are such a hard worker and that you've wanted to excel at what you do. I'm a great believer in that. And probably you have a family to support and you need a lot of money." "No," he said, pacing about. "I don't want to saddle myself with a family until I put some money aside. My store is the first photography store this town has ever had. I have to travel far and at great expense to buy cameras and film. It's thanks to me people have family pictures to hang on their walls, have pictures to go in the newspaper to show what has happened each week. Oh, I've worked hard, 15 hours a day, to get ahead. Now everyone's up in arms because I tried to take your picture. Why wouldn't they, too, want a picture of you if they love you so much? You answer me that." He managed to stop for a minute, to stand still, and to look down at me, where I was sitting. So I said, "You know, I like to think of myself not so much as a person, but as an idea. And I think that's what the townspeople like to think, too. I'm like the mountain itself, a thing that is there, enhancing the town, a thing to feel good about. They would not need a picture of the mountain on their wall, since it's so built into their consciousness from birth." Alim didn't seem to be listening. Instead, he looked at me, looked all around us, and then looked up at the sky as if he'd only just arrived, not only at the Hermitage, but on Earth itself. Do you know, Joe, he said slowly and rather awkwardly, I don't think I've ever been this far up the mountain. It is so nice. He took a deep breath, and then with the exhale, much to his surprise, came tears. The tears poured from his eyes. Well, you never saw such tears.
Then what happened?
I'll tell you what happened. Young Alim stayed on the mountain for 2.5 years. Then he went back to town and got married. His business is thriving, although probably he would be a little richer if he didn't have so many children. And if he didn't go so often to watch the game of the dappled ponies.
Before the great long line of pilgrims would start to arrive, the monks wanted to build a small courtyard at the front of the hermitage, where Joe could sit to receive people. Previously, he had always greeted the pilgrims standing at the front door.
I would say, yes. And they, thinking me an old servant, showing no deference or even much friendliness, would say, I want to see the holy man. Not, hello, how are you today? May I please come in? So, I would then say, come with me, and whisk them along through the hermitage in record time, until they arrived at the back door, where I let them out and said, goodbye. No, but I have come to see the holy man, they would object. And then I would say, well, you have already seen me. And most times I added, if you treat everyone you meet as a holy person, you'll be happy.
And that would be that, which, they'd realize later, was a lot. Of course, there would be some people, more enlightened ones, who would recognize the holy man and Joe and greet him courteously. He would ask them to sit down on a bench just inside the door, and they would talk together. Now Joe was too weak for all this to-ing and fro-ing through the hermitage, and thought that he would just sit by the door to greet the pilgrims, and the monks could take turns ushering them through and out the back, giving them the word. Toward that end, they were building a walled-in area with a bit of shade where he could sit outside during the receiving hours. Kim, that great wrestler of rocks, was fitting stones together without cement to make a bench for Joe to sit on. Kim was being careful not to disturb any of the rocks where the birds were nesting. He moved with Tai Chi slowness as he wandered and pondered through the mountain's boulder garden, eyeing the different shapes and sizes.
If there were times that my artist soul played with the idea of carefully moving a nest to another venue so that I could have a stone my heart was set on, a stone that seemed created just for a certain spot in the body of the future bench, I would fight the desire, knowing it would blight the bench to do so, and that somewhere on the mountain, a better rock was waiting, gloriously nestless.
Jacob and Errol hired a string of the mysterious ponies that were pastured halfway down the mountain and took them to the western foothills, a dry, grassy area where, along the side of a certain stream, it was ideal clay for the making of adobe bricks. They bagged it, put it on the ponies, and hauled it back to the hermitage where, when mixed with the dry winter grasses and hermitage spring water, bricks were formed, then put in the sun to dry. These would make the courtyard walls. Errol, using his architectural skills, had designed the walls to integrate handsomely with the fine, plain style of the hermitage.
I worked alongside the others with a happy heart. And since my hair was always getting in my eyes because of the wind, I ended by, not shaving it after all, but trimming it shorter. I cut up a dress to make a kerchief to wrap around my head, and one by one, the others asked for a kerchief too. So in the end, or at the beginning as it might have been, we were all alike after all, in wheat-coloured robes and gaily printed kerchiefs. The children wore them too. And even the bodyguard felt he was worthy of the kerchief.
How pleasing.
Perhaps it's a new order of monks. Yes, the monks of the Holy Kerchief. The monks of Anna's Holy Kerchief. The Holy Anna-Kerchiefians.
Errol had been busy getting the clay for the adobe and making the bricks and supervising the building of the courtyard, so he'd been in fairly good spirits. As the project reached conclusion, he began to grow restless again.
Anna, will you take a walk with me along the back trail so we can talk privately? Anna, I don't understand what we're doing here. Enough is enough. And don't walk so fast. For years, you told me you were having dreams about a holy man somewhere in the world. You began to look for him, and last summer, you came here, and you found him. And it actually seemed that he was waiting for you. But you didn't stay, you came back home. The next thing that happens is Jacob arrives in Dublin from out of the blue, having tracked you down. He says the holy man is sick and alone and needs you, so off we go. That's fine. It's an adventure for me, and I know it's important to you. I figure you'll nurse him back to health, and then we'll go home. And why am I getting the feeling that we're never going to leave this place?
By now, they were a good half mile from the hermitage on a round knoll overlooking the valley and town, which, today, was covered by a low-lying fog, which made Anna feel they were much higher in the world than the 3,000 feet of the mountain, on some Himalayan height above the clouds.
Oh, I'm glad you brought this up, because I've been meaning to tell you that Joe and I are going off together for a week.
Uh-huh. And for how long exactly have you been meaning to tell me this?
Well, just for a couple of days.
And where are the two of you going?
Well, I'm not sure exactly, but you see, his teacher is very sick, maybe dying. Joe feels he must go to his side. He hasn't seen him for more than 25 years. But he spent 10 years of his life with him, and they're very close. I mean, let's see, Joe was in his 30s when he found this teacher, in Cambodia. But the teacher was only 20, so now he must be 55 or so.
No, I don't like this one bit.
It's something Joe feels he has to do. He wants me to come along so as to continue his teaching. It'll be a learning journey for me.
It is dangerous for an old man and a woman to travel alone in this part of the world.
I think we'll be taking planes and trains. The only tricky part will be getting Joe down the mountain. But we can get one of the ponies for him to ride.
I'll come with you.
Joe wants just the two of us to go. And you'll need to look after the children.
I'll be damned if I'll do that. It's one thing for you to drag us all here. Now you intend to go your merry way without us.
It is only for one little week. Just think of it as a business trip like the many ones you took from Dublin.
Listen here, Anna. I am the man of the family.
So he began to work himself up into a great anger, feeling ill-used by his wife, ill-respected, feeling he was losing control of the marriage and that Anna was being too free with herself. He said unkind and even abusive things to her, but she remained calm. Anna was a person without anger.
I feel sorry for Errol, that he has so much anger inside him. I wish that this story could end like the story of Alim, that Errol could take a deep breath and release his tears. Then he can stay on the mountain and learn to live happily ever after. At the same time, I understand his frustration. He's missing the city, his work, his friends, the pub, the football matches. He's missing coming home to a waiting wife with dinner on the stove, where he is lord and master, instead of sitting down each night at a communal table of silent monks. However, I remember well that he had just as much anger in him in our Dublin life as he has now. Maybe more. Anger, greed, and ignorance are the three poisons, Joe says. But how does one treat such a poison? What is the antidote to anger?
Say something. Why don't you say something? Anything.
Being nice is good luck.
Being married to you is bad luck. Because you are so nice, you just make me feel like a jerk. And you're right.
I am being a jerk. Go ahead. Take your holy business trip. I'll watch the kids. And then when you come back, we'll take it from there.
Anna looked in his eyes, hoping to see them clear and loving, but she saw anger there still, anger in his heart, in the tenseness of his shoulders, and in the veins that stood out on his neck and throbbed with his heightened pulse. She had the feeling that his being nice, by saying what he had just said, was not good luck, that this was one of those bad presents, like Joe had received from the robe woman. That evening, after supper, Joe spoke to the monks.
My teacher, Chen, is very sick. Tomorrow I set out on a journey to go to his side. This is important for me. You may not feel that I am up to the journey, but I assure you I am. Anna will accompany me. Now, I know some of you will wish you were also invited along, and I'm sorry not to include you. It will be a necessary learning journey for Anna. Jacob and Errol are not here just now because they've gone for two of the ponies to take us down the mountain in the morning. In this age of jet travel, I anticipate that the journey and visit will take only a week or so. Now, if any pilgrims arrive while I am gone, I would hope you might start receiving them yourselves, taking turns as the holy man, which all of you are. Or else I would elect Kim to be the door greeter. But he's so young that, well, the pilgrims won't think that he is the one they've come so far to see, and we can continue to play our awakening trick on them, to help set their feet on the path. Perhaps you feel that we are deceiving the pilgrims, not to tell them that I am away, but I think not. You see, it is in the line itself that their trip becomes worthwhile, opening the door to the wisdom that is there, already inside them. Remember that what separates me from other holy men is that I am not a man so much as an idea. By now, all of you have understood that, although perhaps one wouldn't know it with this continuous grumbling from you all.
You are not an idea. You are a man, and you are the man the pilgrims come to see, not us.
Yes, we are all holy persons, but you are the holy man. We can't deceive the pilgrims. It's not right.
It's right, it's not. Yes.
Really? Really? I honestly do not believe that I am any holier than you. And lately I thought I'm a good deal less holy. It is you who can take your holiness into the daily struggle, survive and thrive, while I just sit there.
We carry your wisdom and compassion out into the world. We are the mules, the holy mules. But you are the holy man.
That's right.
Very well.
Yes.
But let's not deny the pilgrims this glorious walk up the mountain and the chance to talk with you all.
I think we had better put a sign at the beginning of the trail saying that the holy man is gone. That's a fair thing.
Indeed. Indeed you are, mules. Stubborn as mules. Already it looks like I'm no longer the boss around here. Well, very well. The holy man is gone, but not yet. For my farewell tonight, I want you to talk about what has made you exceptional in your field. This is for Anna. You have all become successful, even famous, through talent, discipline and perseverance, the three main qualities for achievement. And you chose to set off on the journey towards wisdom and compassion. What is this extra quality that has made you such consummate artists in your work? What has made you unique? Helena, please, go first.
Helena stood up. Her brown skin glowed in the soft evening light. She cupped her chin in her hand.
Well, now, let's see. I'm going to have to think a little about this, Joe. I know. The the notion first came to me to be a chef when I was little and heard a story about a king who wanted to eat something that was very hot and very cold at the same time. Chefs from all around the land tried to satisfy his fantasy, and no one could do it. I think it was a kitchen boy with a wide-open beginner's mind who took the necessary intuitive leap. He set to work and came up with the very first hot fudge sundae. So, I got interested in cooking, and every time I ate something good, whether it was cooked by friends of my mom or some restaurant chef, I tried to get the recipe, and wouldn't you know, no one would ever give it to me. At least, not the whole thing. Great cooks are the most withholding darn people you ever knew. They want to be famous for whatever their dish is, and they figure if they give it away, they give away their hard-won celebrity too.
Ah, I can understand that.
Yeah. So, I vowed that when I got famous, I was going to tell everyone how to cook just as well as me, and that's what I'm doing. Instead of being a big deal chef in a famous restaurant, I've got all my cooking schools. And another thing, I cook food that's good for you. It doesn't just taste delicious, it makes you healthy and glad. I grew up to believe French cuisine was the greatest, but man, it's so full of fat and sugar, it's not funny. You know, you go into the projects and other places where poor people live and no one knows how to cook anymore. They go to McDonald's or get takeout. It's hamburgers and pizzas for these folks, if it's anything. It would break your heart to see how those little kids never come home to a nice home-cooked dinner. The good smells, the family closeness of sitting around a table set pretty with maybe a flower or two and a vase in the middle. That's something they just don't have any experience of. So I tried to teach the mothers and fathers how to shop, prepare, and present healthy food. It doesn't even cost them more than all the takeouts and Big Macs. I go into their area, I open a little restaurant, and show them what I have in mind, and then I start giving classes. So, what am I trying to say here? For that matter, I think I forgot exactly what it was Joe asked.
But you've answered it, Helena. You're a unique chef because of your generosity.
I'll go next, since Helena's talk segues into mine.
Henri's bright eyes flickered around the room, and even in the flowing wheat-colored robe, he managed to look like a sharp dresser.
A lot of those little kids that don't get to eat healthy food at the family kitchen table grow up to be the scum of the earth. They grow up stupid, mean-hearted, greedy, and angry. You might say they are brain-dead and soul-dead. All they care about is money. And when they get it, they haven't an idea in the world what to do with it to make their lives better. They think a new pair of trainers will make everything cool, then a leather jacket and a new car if they live that long, but it doesn't make everything cool. They still don't have a home with good food and some flowers on the table, nice music, and loving companions.
And that's sad.
Yes. And in Marseille, there is a lot of rage among the young who are Algerian or Moroccan, sometimes Vietnamese or Chinese. Education is available, but they drop out too soon. There is so much unemployment. They feel they have no future. And of course, there is racism. For them, there is only the solace of heroin and the community of gangs. If they leave, they come into the justice system. But there's no way in the world they're going to get a good lawyer who will care about their case. Until they meet me. Why do I care? Why do I want to get these monsters off free so as to send them back onto the streets to steal some more, perhaps to kill? Because I am their chance, not their second chance, their first. These kids, who never once had a chance, now, by some miracle, have me. They get my expertise as a lawyer and my friendship as a man. I tell them I'll get them off drugs and crime and get them help. And if they do get straight, I'll help them to stay in school. Maybe even see them through university, if they can hack it. Meanwhile, my young protégés can come to my apartment anytime they want and have a home-cooked meal cooked by my in-house chef, trained by Helena. They can bring the flowers for the table as long as they don't steal them out of someone's garden on the way. It's quite a sight seeing these hard cases come up my steps carrying a bunch of flowers. But that's nothing. Now, some of them are growing flowers. I am a good lawyer because I believe that everyone deserves a chance at redemption, a chance to begin again and do it right. And I'm here to give them the chance. All that scum of the earth, after all, is holy scum of the earth.
Ori's unique gift is the same as Helena's. Generosity. The more you give, the more you get back. Generosity is inexhaustible.
By the way, my success rate is pathetic, about 10%. But you can believe they are all going to be first-chance givers, too, helping others out of the mire. The ripple effect is going to take some hundreds of years. But it's rippling right now as I speak.
Your turn, Maria.
I owe my success as a scientist to failure. That is something you don't hear so much about. All the times you try something and it doesn't work. I'm talking hundreds of times. All the experiments that go whoop, belly up. It can get you down. But that's when you try again. All that trying and failing, that's what makes you good at your job. And that's the fun of it, too. What a bore it would be if everything worked out fine the first time you tried it. How would you grow? How would you learn? People tend to give up after a lot of failure or rejection. I believe you have to embrace failure, really love it, say, oh, thank you, this is great. Now I get to try again and do it right, or at least do it better. Come a little closer to what I was after, to what I was trying to find out. There was the time, which is how I got famous, that I didn't find out what I was looking for, but I discovered something else along the way, something no one else had found or understood before. Accidenti! Wasn't it lucky I hadn't let myself get too discouraged to go on? I guess that's it. Short and sweet.
Well, Maria thinks she's talking about failure. But she's really talking about perseverance. And this is a sublime quality, a noble virtue. Without perseverance, there can be no greatness. But failure is its instigator. When you do something good, it's tempting to stop right there and hold on to it for all you're worth. But that's just playing safe. You must let the victory go. Give it away. And take in the failure instead. As Maria has said, embrace failure. It has come to help you grow. Thank you, Maria. Ed, how about a contribution from you?
I was always a slob. Never was there a man who loved to sleep so much as me. I only got up in the mornings because I knew that pretty soon I could lie down again and read a book, muse about things, or take a nap. I was the kind of child of whom they said, he lives in another world. I decided early on that being a poet was the life for me. It would require the least exertion. As an adult, I discovered that there was always a woman who was more than happy to take care of me, to cook and clean, keep a roof over my head and clothes on my back, in return for which she got to tell people that she was the poet's girlfriend. Sometimes years would go by before she realized that this was not a good deal. Before she realized that it was only a deal. It wasn't love. I was a taker. When I began to spend summers with Joe and live with the group, none of whom was my girlfriend, I had to change my ways. I had to exert myself for the good of the group, and I found it a joyful experience. I felt happier, more energetic, and more disciplined. I wasn't in another world. I was being attentive to this world, to my every action. When I went home, I began to live alone and take care of myself. I am still lazy. I still lie around a lot and do nothing, and my apartment is messy. The refrigerator is a horror, and we won't even talk about the grease in the stove. Someday it will go up like a torch. I wander in the woods, hours on end, not even really thinking. But my creativity seems to lie in my laziness, and as long as I'm not hurting others with it or taking from others because of it, then I'm okay. And my poetry's okay, too.
But you could say instead that yours is a gentle life, an uncontrolled life. You allow for the unpredictable, the spontaneous. Because you are so incredibly relaxed, you're open to experience and thought. You allow space in your daily life for your art to enter. All this sounds better than laziness, doesn't it? But you're right. It is all laziness.
I am trying to learn from Ed. I am so controlled, efficient, and industrious. There is nothing I fear more than a day with the calendar empty. 2 days, and I would shoot myself. I'm in love with my schedule. The busier, the better. I haven't done a spontaneous thing since the day I was born.
But you came here.
Yes, but it wasn't spontaneous. It was on my list of things to do in the future, and one day the future came. Even so, I only have you down for 3 weeks this spring. It's pitiful. My only 3 weeks in the year to let down. And I use up one of them just going through telephone withdrawal.
Oh, just keep on smelling the flowers the kids bring you. You'll be okay.
Both laziness and overaction spring from fear of life, death, of being who you are, of knowing who you are. They're escapes. However, both action and non-action can be creative ways to live. If you pay attention, and if you spend time with yourself, being yourself, then you will know the truth that is in you, and the holy person that you are. Kim, can you say something?
I was born with many gifts. The bones and musculature, the size and shape to be a precision runner. I sought out the best coaches and threw myself into my training with all my heart. I had all the gear with which to excel, but it wasn't enough for me. I wanted nothing less than to be one with the universe, to link up to the energy, the breath of the universe, and therefore enable myself to go farther and faster than was humanly possible. This sounds ambitious, but it actually meant giving up my ambition, giving up my ego. That's when I found Joe for a teacher, so that I could learn to give myself over, learn to relax my body and have my mind be still. Even as I ran at phenomenal speed for hours, I learned to spurn the physical self. Running, I am no longer muscles, organs, bones. My molecular structure becomes one with the very air itself. I am as light and free-moving as air. I am no longer human. Except at such a moment when I trip and fall. Then I become strangely human again. So human that I bleed abundantly and sometimes, I'm sorry to say, cry tears of the same abundance. So, perhaps I haven't quite got it down perfectly, but I must still be clinging to my ego, which trips me up every time. I haven't completely blended with the breath of the universe, but that's my aim. As for a name for this quality, I'm not sure. Any ideas? And please don't say stupidity.
Fearlessness. We will call it fearlessness. To seek to do the impossible, to give yourself over, mind, body, heart, and soul, to err, which is to dare to be nothing. Fearlessness is not bravery, it's not courage. So what is it? It is calmness.
Errol and Jacob, having returned to the hermitage with the ponies and tethered them by the spring, had entered the room at the beginning of Kim's talk.
Welcome. We are each taking turns telling of the special quality within ourselves that has contributed to our achievement and perhaps made us unique. Ho, you will be the last to speak.
There is a quote by Congreve. Music has charms to soothe a savage breast. When I was young, I heard someone misquote it, saying that music can soothe the savage beast. It captured my imagination and sent me on my cello-playing path. When I became a performing musician, I never got to play to the wild tigers and lions I had imagined as a child. But I knew that in my audience would be men and women who were savage, who were cold and uncaring, selfish, angry, consumed by ongoing desires to possess rather than to give. What was wonderful was that such people came to hear music. They liked it. In the sheath of steel over their heart was a tiny crack to let in soothing sound and allow rapture. That meant there was hope for them. If there was a crack, the crack could widen. If I played really beautifully, if I was full of music, if my music was informed with a glorious idea of love and laughter, then, unbeknownst to the beast, the crack would widen and the heart would be touched. When the heart was touched, the idea of compassion could be awakened within them, and they would begin to change. For the good.
So, from Helena and Henri, we have learnt the precept of generosity. From Maria, the virtue of perseverance. Ed has shown us the creative power of an uncontrolled life. Kim, the freedom of fearlessness. And now Ho tells us that the mastery of an instrument played with all one's soul can melt the stoniest heart.
Can I speak?
Of course, Jacob.
I guess everyone here knows that I joined the Foreign Legion when I was a youth, not to soothe the wild beast, but to be one. I deludedly thought it would be a grand adventure, but it was a slaughter. 3 years later, when I came home, not a hero, but a killer, I built that steel sheath over my heart, thinking to protect myself. I put the war behind me and vowed to tell no one about it, but to try to live a decent life. I did so. I studied and worked hard. I was successful and good to my employees. I married, had children, served my town, gave to the poor.
This is good.
But I hadn't changed. I was only a secret keeper, a pretender. I hadn't even begun to change, because there was no crack in my careful armor. The boy slaughterer was imprisoned. He was in mortal shame, begging to be let out and forgiven, not forgotten. It was not until my 40s that my armor began to crack, but not for the good. I began to disintegrate as a person. Each crack was like a wound. I was depressed, alcoholic, caught in my ego, angry and hateful. But something awakening must have got into one of the cracks. Now, maybe at someone's home I heard one of Ho's recordings. Maybe one day on television I saw Kim win a marathon and heard his transforming words. Or on my travels stepped into one of Helena's restaurants and felt an imminence of peace. Whatever it was, I got it in my mind to come to Joe for help and to dare to present not my pretend self, but the boy slaughterer himself.
And you did the right thing.
So, this is not to tell you what to be. It's what not to do and be. Don't keep secrets. Don't pretend. Don't be a hypocrite. Don't manipulate others. And, yeah, don't be dishonest. That's it.
Errol, do you want to say anything?
No. No, thanks. I'm afraid I just don't get it. I mean, sometimes I think you're all living in another world up here.
Anna?
Hearing Jacob talk about the harm of keeping a secret, I'm going to tell you what I've never told a soul, except recently Joe. I guess Jacob and I are changing the tenor of the evening. Instead of describing what makes us good, we're explaining...